Evening, we open Chumash Shemos, Sefer HaGeula, B'Sha'a Tova, and one step ahead of the weather. What's curious about the opening of Chumash Shemos, Parshas Shemos, even before we get to the contents, is the way that it opens. We've actually noted this in the past. For the opening words of Shemos are Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael. Chumash Shemos begins with a Vav. It begins by saying and. And if we are particular, it should strike us that a new Chumash, being a new Sefer, shouldn't really start with the word and. Rashi starts Rashi's. You can't start Uber Rashi's. It is true that the next two Chumashim also start with the letter Vav, but we should not be thrown by that. The Vav of Vayikra and the Vav at the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, Vayidaber, of course Bamidbar starts Vayidaber, Hashem and Moshe Bamidbar Sinai. For obvious reasons, the Chumash is called Bamidbar and not Vayidaber. Those vavs, strictly speaking, do not mean and. They are the vav ahipuch, the vav conversive. They turn yikra and yidaber, which are future, to the past. Vayikra, vayidaber. People who are particular about these things, they would not translate the word vayidaber as and he spoke, but rather he spoke. The vav there functions to change the future to the past and vice versa. Not to mean and, which leaves the vav of Shemos, which does mean and. It's the vav hachibur, the vav conjunctive. How can you start at the beginning with the word and? And this question is raised by the Netziv in his introduction to the HaMikdavar of Chumash Shemos. And he draws our attention to the fact that whereas we give the names to the Chumashim either after the first word of the Chumash, Bereshis, or Vayikra, or the first distinctive word, Bamidbar, Devarim, Eileha Devarim. There is a tradition, and it's expressed in the writings of the Bahag, the Bal Halachas Gedolos. The Bahag is from the time of the Gaonim, the 800s, or earlier even, Rabbi Shimon Kayora. And the Bahag has characteristic names for the Chumashim. Bereshis he calls Chumash HaYetzira, the Chumash of creation. Vayikra will be called Teras Kohanim. These are also names that Chazal use, some of them. Lahavdil, really Lahavdil, but in the vernacular, the English also follows this. Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus, Teras Kohanim, they didn't call it Kohanicus, they called it Leviticus, but it's the same idea. It's about the character of the Sefer, and Bamidbar is Chumash HaPikudim, numbers, the Chumash of counting, and Devarim is Deuteronomy, Mishnah Torah, the saying over of the Torah. What does the Bahag call Shemos? He refers to Shemos as Chumash Sheni. That's his list. So Bereshis is Chumash HaYetzira, Shemos Chumash Sheni, Teras Kohanim, Chumash HaPikudim, and Mishnah Torah. We cannot help but notice that Chumash Shemos seems to have gotten a rather poor characterization. What is there to say about it? It's the second Chumash, Chumash Sheni. Well, Vayikra's Chumash Shlishi, but it had a characterization. What does the Bahag mean to indicate by referring to Shemos with what seems to be numerical and no more? Chumash Sheni. And then the Netziv explains that in fact the Bahag is imparting a major message for us. But what is Chumash Shemos about? Chumash Shemos is the deliverance of the Jewish people, the giving of the Torah. When we go back to Bereshis, and Bereshis is all about creation, it's worthwhile asking a very interesting question, perhaps simple looking. When was creation of the world completed? Well, Sheshes Yomim, Asa Hashem, Asa Shamayim, Asa Aret, it took 6 days. By the time you get to Sheni of Bereshis, everything's there. Yet as we know, from a certain point of view, the world may have been called into being in Chumash Bereshis, but it isn't set, it isn't concretized. For on the very words, Vayyerev, Vayyivoker, Yom Hashishi, Friday is called Yom Hashishi, as distinct from all the other days, which are Yom Sheni and Yom Shlishi Revi'i, not Yom Hasheni Hashlishi. Rashi gives two interpretations, and both of them are heading towards the same river. Namely, that ultimately, in the fullest sense, the creation of the world is not set until the Jewish people receive the Torah. The very first word of Bereshis tells us, Bishvil Yisrael Shenikra Reishis, Bishvil HaTorah Shenikra Reishis. Which means that the world is somewhat conditional upon the Jewish people receiving the Torah. Yom HaShishi, it's the Hei HaYadiyah, for it refers to a Yom HaShishi very much in the future, the 6th of Sivan, or the Hei refers to the Chamishachum Shei Torah, which tells us that whereas in general or in principle, the world is created in the beginning of Bereshis, but the final step, the Makkeh B'Patish, we could say, of the creation of the world, what sets it, is the receiving of the Torah. And that is something that takes place in Chumash Shemos. It turns out, therefore, says Netziv, that if we were to refer to the first Chumash as Chumash HaYetzirah, the Chumash of creation, the Bahag says it is proper and correct to refer to Shemos as Chumash Sheni, for it is the second Chumash of Yetzirah. It's the second Chumash of creation, for it is in Chumash Shemos that creation is finalized. That is what he learned from this seemingly anomalous terminology of the Bahag for Chumash Shemos. And in keeping with this, says Netziv, to understand in this fascinating vision, really, how Chumash Shemos is really a continuation of the process of Chumash Bereshis, Chumash Sheni, so how appropriate it is that it begins with the letter Vav. And it continues. On the one hand, it's a new Chumash, of course, so many new things, it's the beginning of the Jewish nation, and it is a new Chumash, but on the other hand, it is a continuation of the business that began of Berea in Chumash Bereshis and Chumash HaYetzirah. The Eilesh Shemos. What is contained within a letter is quite outstanding. These are the words of the Netziv in his introduction to the HaMikdover of Shemos, and they are a wonderful lesson really to accompany us through Chumash Shemos. It is Chumash HaYetzirah Part 2. As we know, the Chumash does not begin, Shemos does not begin with the giving of the Torah, it begins with difficult times for Bnei Yisrael. And there's a phrase which is very much in our consciousness about the difficulties, which is referred to or found in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Perek Aleph Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayavidu Mitzrayim, they've had their plans, the Jewish people are going to take over the world, they've got to stop them. And they enslave them, Vayavidu Mitzrayim es Bnei Yisrael Befarech. They enslave them with breaking work, work that breaks. Lifroch is to crumble. Parich, if something is crumbly, it's parich. And that's an expression of just how difficult the servitude was. It broke the Jewish people. It's a very well-known drosha. It's mentioned in the Gemara in Maseches Sota, in the end of the first perek, that parech, or perech, can be seen as a contraction of two words, perach. Perach means soft mouth, soft, enticing speech. And what does this refer to? Originally, the Jewish people were lured and enticed into working. Conditions were good, everyone was doing it. And that's how it really began. The Jewish people really walked headlong into their what became their enslavement. Little by little, the pay got less, the work got harder. Before they looked around, no one else was working. They were the only ones left. Indeed, we've mentioned in the past, this is the Bior, which is given by Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, the author of the Arch Laner, in the introduction to his Perush on Haggadah Shel Pesach, called Minchas Oni. He quotes a comment of the Zohar HaKadosh, which is opaque in the extreme. The Pasuk says, in Pasuk Yudalet, Vayimaru es chayim, they embitter their lives by avodah kasha, with hard work, bechomer uvilveinim. Chomer, cement, levenim, bricks. Says the Zohar HaKadosh, bechomer, which the translation of chomer is cement, says the Zohar, bechomer, do kal vachomer. Kal vachomer. You say chomer, I say kal vachomer. We know what a kal vachomer is. If this is such and such, then how much more so in the stronger case, kal vachomer. We say it, it's one of Rabbi Shmuel's 13 principles, Shetorin Adreshes Ben, be kal vachomer. That's somewhat enigmatic. And moreover, the Zohar goes on to say, not only b'kal v'chomer, because they were shava. After all, why stop the list at number one? You look at Rabbi Shmuel's principles, kal v'chomer, because they were shava. And what does all of this mean? And the Arch Laner explains that this is the Zohar's way, using these halachic terms, of referring to what was so difficult about the servitude, the way in which we came to be enslaved. As we said, originally, the work wasn't that difficult. And we got paid. So that's the Masorah, that's so say Chazal. But slowly but surely, the pay subsided, it waned, and the work got harder. But we were in. It's difficult to find the day that you'll leave, because it's incremental, and every day is negligible in terms of the difference from yesterday, and maybe tomorrow will be better, but it only gets worse. Says the Arch Laner, that's kal vachomer. Kal vachomer means easy and hard. It's a progression. That's how we got chapped. It began kal and became chamor. Kal vachomer. And there's a second aspect also. Because initially, it was a nationwide project. Everyone turned up. It wasn't just for Jews. It was non-denominational. For all Egyptians, all good Egyptian citizens. And Paro himself turned up on day one. And he cut the ribbon and laid the first brick. So which good Jew could see all good Egyptians coming forward to do their part and would stay at home? It's partisan. And therefore, the Jews turned up with the rest of them. Slowly but surely, everyone else receded till it was just them. But again, what's the day that you decide we're not going to turn up? In the words of the Zohar, Gezeira Shava. Gezeira Shava. The original decree was Shava. It was equal for everyone. Everyone was in it equally. Just in the course of time, the Jewish people ended up more equally than everybody else until it was just them. So these are the terms that the Zohar Kodesh enlists to describe how things began. Kal became Chomer. It was originally a Gezeira Shava, and all of that's encapsulated within the word Perach. It began so nice, and who are we to refuse? Now we should note that this seems to be a far cry, this drasha of Perach, from the pshat of the pasuk. I mean, Perach is a word, and it means to break, and Perach means soft speech. It's a drasha, and maybe that's how it is. But the truth of the matter is that really what the Gemara is saying is that from a certain point of view, the Perach is what broke the Jewish people most of all. It really is the Perach, in the sense that difficult physical conditions, they are what they are. And it doesn't make them not difficult. But there's something about the mental anguish, really, of being in a difficult situation and knowing that you allowed yourself to fall into it. That's the feeling that accompanies the Jewish people as they're trapped now. Every day they remember, we walked into this. there's a certain that breaks a person sometimes more than the physical labor itself. That's the psychological aspect, and therefore, on the face of it, parech and perach have nothing in common, but it's not so. The perach is what broke most of all. And we should note further in this, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says, that it's for this reason that we left Mitzrayim under very interesting circumstances, in a very specific way. We borrowed things from the Egyptians. These understanding was that we would give them back, but we weren't coming back. And this was a realization that dawned on them after 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, until the penny dropped. But there was no penny left. The Jewish people had taken everything. What have we done? And Mefarshim asked, why did we leave Mitzrayim in that way? Had we told them we're not coming back, they would have probably gladly parted with all their possessions anyway. I mean, the place is falling to pieces. But the Rechaim HaKadosh says that so much, as we know, of Yetzias Mitzrayim is Mido Keneged Mido. Each of the Aseres HaDibros, as described by the Midrashim and the Mefarshim, it's measure for measure. That's the way that the retribution came. And also in this, says the Rechaim, was Mido Keneged Mido. In other words, the Mitzrayim had to know what it's like when you realize that you've been duped into something, because that's what they did. That's how they got the Jewish people to work for them. And therefore, that moment of realization that they're not coming, that we gave them our things, and they fooled us. So they did. That's the final installment of the punishment for the Mitzrayim for the way that they began to enslave the Jewish people. So these are very interesting and important aspects of the situation that come out through the Psukim in the beginning of the Parsha. Now, in Perek Beis, which discusses the birth of Moshe, I would like to refer to three comments of the Maharal. They're all grouped together in the same chapter of the Sefer Gevuras Hashem. Gevuras Hashem is the Sefer of the Maharal that deals with matters of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Galus Mitzrayim, Yetzias Mitzrayim. And these three comments, they are three chidushim. They open up worlds for us. And they all refer to a couple of psukim here in the beginning of Perek Beis. So we have Amram and Yocheved, and then Moshe is born. Pasuk Beis is Vatahar Isha Vatelet Bein. She conceived, she bears Moshe, Vatero Sokitofu, she saw that he was good, and that's why the Rashi quotes the Medrash that the house was filled with light. I mean, the Pasuk just said he was good. But the Mefarshim say, well, what mother looks at her son and says he's not good? I mean, every child is good. The child is born, the mother looks at him and says, he's good. Of course he's good. So the Pasuk says, Vatero Sokito, it's beyond what every mother will look at her child. Woe to the person who dares contradict her. Vatero Sokito means the house is filled with light. Vatet Paneu Shlosh Yerachim, she hid him as long as she could. But she couldn't hide him any longer. They reached a stage where she couldn't hide him anymore, and therefore, as we know, she took the basket and she put it into the Nile. Maharal notes that if you look at the word hatsfina in the beginning of the pasuk, that she couldn't hide him anymore. Something is unusual. The letter tzaddik has a dot, known as a dogish. Says Maharal, there is no explanation for this dogish. So it's interesting, because I think most of us would happily see this pasuk many times and not notice that there's an extra dogish. We wouldn't notice it as extra. So you have to know diktuk to realize that it's redundant. But no knowledge of diktuk will help you. Because if you know how the word is constructed, there's no explanation as to why there should be this dot in the tzadi. There's no grammatical explanation. Says Maharal, that's because the explanation here is not grammatical. It is extra grammatical. What does that mean? Says Maharal, Yocheved held on to Moshe as long as she could. She hid him for as long as she could. As long as there was a chance, she's not going to part with him. Which means that she went to whatever length possible until she realized that it couldn't happen anymore. The role of a doggish, grammatically, is to lay stress on something, to lay emphasis on something. It has a certain intensity. It will make it turn a fey into a pay, a vein into a base, and so on and so forth. It intensifies the pronunciation. Here, says Maharal, a fascinating thing. The Pasuk puts a doggish in the letter tzaddik of her hiding Moshe to reflect the fact that she went through every effort possible to hide him. The doggish of in the letter, it has no grammatical function, but it does the same for the situation as it would for grammar. Namely, as surely as grammatically it adds a level of intensity, here it's telling us that as hard as she tried to hide him, as intensely as she tried to hide him, she wasn't able to. It's a fascinating comment, because the world of diktuk and the world of everything else often seem to be very much self-contained, and they are. And one can go through a lot of chumash, know very little diktuk, and hope for the best. But sometimes the wall between them breaks down, and you have diktuk features that are actually more a conceptual commentary than they are the easing pronunciation or anything else. And it's fascinating to consider where else this may feature. There are another couple of places, Mirat Hashem, we can comment on them when we get there. But in the meanwhile, this extra grammatical doggish, it's a situational doggish. It's not a grammatical doggish, which is half levafel. That's the first comment of the Maharal. And one, I think one needs to be the Maharal to say something like that. So she puts him on the Nile. Pasuk Dalet, Vatesatzad achoso merachok. And his sister, Miriam, so she stands off at a distance, a safe distance, hopefully, to see what will happen with him. And then we know what happens with him. But just at this moment, no one knows what's going to happen with him. Everyone else goes home, but Miriam stays. She's waiting at a distance. The word vateisatzav, how would we translate it? She stood. It's from the word nitzav, of course, nitzavim. She stood. She positioned herself. Says Maharal, once again, without getting into too many details, you should note, the word vateisatzav has no family. It doesn't answer to any grammatical grouping. What is it? We know our binyanim. There's the reflexive, and there's the causative, and there's the passive. This is none of them. What does it sound like? You've got the two tafs there, vateisatzav. Sounds a little bit like a reflexive. That's always going to be in the feminine. Third person feminine. There'll be two tafs. But it's not a reflexive. It's not a spoil. Because if it was, the word would have been vatisyatsev. Like Bilam says to Balak, hisyatsev ko al olasecha. Should have said vatisyatsev. It doesn't say that. It says vateisatzav. What else could it be? Well, maybe it's a passive. Maybe she was stood there. But there shouldn't be two tufts. It should just say vateisatsav. So we're nowhere. There's nowhere you can put this. So what does it mean? What are we to make of this word that has no home? What's the background, says Maharal, to Miriam staying? Was she the only one who was interested as to what would happen? Was she the only one who was available? The Gemara says, Miriam had already received nevuah about Moshe. The Pasuk in Parshas Beshalach calls her Miriam HaNaviah Achos Aaron. And the Gemara says, what, she's only Aaron's sister? She's not Moshe's sister? Why, when she's called a Neviah, is she referred to as Aaron's sister? It says the Gemara, it's to tell you that she received Nevuah before Moshe was born, and all there was to be a sister was of Aaron, because she received Nevuah about Moshe. When her parents got back together again, they'd separated, but then Miriam gave Musar to her father, and they got back together again with Yocheved. Miriam had a Nevuah. And she said, this child will be, he will be the Moshiach Anshel Yisrael. And everything looked promising. When he was born, the house was filled with light. And Miriam got a great Yeshar Koach from everyone. This is it. This is the child. And then they put him on the Nile. And now everyone's looking at Miriam and saying, well, I thought you had a nevuah about this child, and we've got to let him go. Doesn't look like it's going to happen. But Miriam knows it's going to happen. Or at the very least, she's received a nevuah. She's the one who's closest to these situations. She's had a nevuah about this child. So she can't just go home. She's not going to give up. She has to see what happens. That's the background to Miriam staying. What will be with her nevuah about him? We find, occasionally, in the Chumash, a fascinating phenomenon, which is called Milim Murkavot. Milim Murkavot are composite words. That means that they don't answer to any one designation. They've got elements of different things, different ingredients, different components. A classic example which we've mentioned in the past, and it relates to this week's Parsha, and it bears out the point, it expresses it very clearly, is in the end of Perek Beis, when Moshe is running, he comes to the well. Yisro had 7 daughters. They came to the well. They were harassed. They were shooed away. Vayavo haroim vayigarshum. And Moshe saved them, and that was the beginning, really, of his relationship with Yisro and with the Tzipora. Vayavo haroim vayigarshum. Says the Ksava Kabbalah. Look at the word vayigarshum, which is written that way, ends with a mem. You will have a shaila, because the suffix of that mem is about them. It's about Yisro's daughters. They shooed them away, but they're all girls. The way you end a feminine noun, plural, is not with a mem; it's with a nun. It should have said vayavo harom vayigarshun. That's proper Lashon HaKodesh. So why does it end it with a mem, which is appropriate for a masculine noun? Let's go China. So Zaksava Kabbalah, ask another Shaila. Why are Yisro's daughters being harassed? What did they ever do to anyone? Have they been causing trouble? No. Yisro has been causing trouble. They are part of his family. Yisro caused a great deal of ill will because he was priest of Avodah Zarah for the town, and he chucked it all in. He saw that it was Narishkeit. So there's nothing that's more guaranteed to promote bad feeling amongst an idol-worshipping town than to be the head of it all and then just to retire. And they made his life a misery, him and his family. Which means that the reason why his daughters were experiencing such difficulties is because of him. And that is why, says the Ksava Kabbalah, the Pasuk gives a kind of a masculine element to their troubles. They're all girls. It should have had a nun, but it ends with a mem, vayigarshum. There's a male aspect here. Why? Because it's because of their father that they're experiencing these troubles. It's amazing how the Pasuk kind of gives you, it synthesizes these elements into words that are now composite words. Says the Maharal, and in a sense he's before the Ksava Kabbalah, of course, our situation is analogous, similar to that. Everyone goes away, Miriam stays. Why does she stay? Does she have to stay? Yes and no. Meaning, was it her decision? Did someone make her stay? No. Is it her decision? Yes. The Loshon Hispa'el is when you decide. You do something to yourself. Lehityatzev is for you to make a decision to be somewhere. Nitzav, nifal, when you're passive, that means that you're being moved by someone else. Normally, they're contradictory to each other. It's either your decision or you're being moved by something else. Unless, says Maharal, it's your decision, of course, but it's a decision you can't fail to make. Destiny is keeps Miriam rooted to the spot. She's received a nevuah. She can't leave. In principle, of course, she could. And it's her decision. But it's a decision that she can't fail to take. And therefore you have this amazing situation where Miriam, she's standing there. Does she have to stand there? Yes. Really, she does. Could she leave? If she wants to, but she can't leave. So it's a fascinating blend. It's a decision that she has to make. And therefore, this word is a composite of a hispael, because it has two tufts, but it's vowelized much more like a nifal. And then you get that composite situation of a decision that she made that she couldn't not make. Once again, an amazing concept. And it's all just from, one needs to know a little bit of Lashon HaKodesh, but just enough to know that anything you do know won't help you. And then these other ideas come in. Now Miriam, pardon me, Batya now, in Pasuk, hey, Vateret Bas Parah, she's a cool Batya here, we know that she's Batya. Vateret Bas Parah Lechotzal Al Hayor, so she goes down to bathe on the Nile, Venaroseh Hochotzal Yad Hayor, and her handmaidens there, they're also there, and she sees, Vateret Sateva B'toch HaSuf, and she sees this basket, and she reaches out to get it. Now, the focus, of course, is on Batya. She's the one. But the Pasuk also does mention her entourage, her handmaidens, Venaroseh Holchos Al Yad Hayor. What are they doing? Well, the Pasuk just says that they're going. They're going by the Nile. Apparently they're just accompanying her. I mean they're her entourage. And that's a simple understanding. But Rashi quotes a medrash, and this medrash is also from the Gemara in the end of the first parak of Sota. For Rabbeinu Darshu, this is unbelievable, difficult to see this coming. Rabbeinu Darshu Holchos, you know what the Pasuk means when it says that her handmaidens are going? Loshon Misa means they're dying. What's Holchos got to do with dying? Kumo, like it says, Hine Anochi Holech Lamus. Who said that? Esav said it in his with the Nezid Adashim, as he tells the Bechor as a prelude. Hine Anochi Holech Lamus. So he says, I'm going to die. Says Rashi, therefore going means, it's an expression of death. Why? Why do they die? Says Rashi again from the Gemara, Holchos Lamus Lefishe Michuba. They try to stop Batya. They saw that she's going to pick Moshe up or whoever is in this basket. They tried to frustrate the whole thing, and therefore they all died. Now, firstly, the pasuk just seems to say that they're just going. How do we get from going to dying, even with Hineo Nochi Holech Lamus? It's still quite a distance, it seems. What is it about the Pasuk that can't just be Kipshuto? Maybe they're just there the way the entourage is always there. So Maral says that actually the Pasuk is rather difficult because it states that Paro's daughter, she went down to bathe and her handmaidens, they're going. Except where are they going? I mean, what does that even mean? If she's bathing in the Nile, then she's in one place, so then her entourage should be there in one place. Where are they going? Are they going away from her? So the whole scalar of Naroseh Holchos, she's here and they're moving away. Why'd they go away? That's a chat question. Okay, nonetheless, Rashi's answer is quite drastic. If they're going away, that means they're really going away. Further, you should note, says Maharal, interesting, look at the word holchos. It's written very chaser. Meaning holchos really should have two vavs in it. Hey vav, lamed kaf, vav taf. Both vavs are missing. So this is a very substandard word. There's a lot missing here. It's chaser, because they're chaser. Moreover, the word holchos itself, now hey lamed kaf taf. If you look at those letters, they have a gematria of, says Maral, 455. Taf is 400, Kaf and Lamed is 1320, it's 50, and He is 5. That's the gematria of the word Misa, which is death. Now, that means that we're receiving a lot of, let's say, messages, but you could still argue that they're shortwave messages. In other words, missing vavs and gematrias and kind of anomalous directions. And the pasuk does everything except to say that they died. And Maharal in the Gevuras Hashem asks, well, wouldn't that have been easier? Instead of having me reach for my calculator and work out the gematria, etc., and know that there's missing vavs, etc., and so forth, I get the message at the end, but couldn't it have been expressed clearer? And the answer of the Maharal is foundational. And in fact, we mentioned in passing last week that there's an explanation of the Pachad Yitzchak. We said it's based on the Maharal, that we didn't have time for it. I didn't feel that bad leaving it out because it's this Maharal. I knew we'd get to it in a week's time. So if you've borne the suspense, here it is. So the Maharal says that as far as he understands, when the Gemara says that they tried to interfere and they tried to stop Batya, so they all died, it doesn't mean that they died. That is to say, it doesn't mean that they dropped dead. Because there's no need for that to happen. Clearly, that's a heavenly interference. But they just need to be stopped from interfering. That's all. It's enough for them to be weakened. It's enough for their resolve to be weakened. It's enough for their capacity to be weakened. In order to allow Batya to prevail, which is the natural situation. She's the princess. They're nothing. The chiddush is that they try to stop her. I mean, that's anti-Semitism conquers all. It frustrates the regal order. There's only one thing that would ever have them speak up in the presence of their mistress and try to counter an act, and that's if she's looking to save a Jewish child. Apparently. So the natural order just needs to be reinstated, that they're not able to impose their will on her and not able to stop. In other words, says Maharal, the concept of life is everything up to 100%. As soon as a person is not able to act the way they would like to, or finds themselves unable to follow through on something, or somehow hampered or frustrated, in this respect, they're dead. But it's not drop dead. And that, says Maharal, is why the Pasuk doesn't say that they died. Because they didn't die in that way. And here is where the Maharal is telling us that there exists this parallel between the level to which something is explicit in the Pasuk and the level to which it is manifest in physical reality. The Pasuk will not say that they died, will not say Vayamusu, unless they dropped dead. But that's not what happened. What happened was they were unable to prevent Batya from taking Moshe, which is itself a form of Misa, because they're curtailed, they're restrained, paralyzed. But because it's a much more subtle usage of the concept of Misa, the Pasuk indicates it to you in this much more subtle way. Anyone who was there, this is what the Maharal is saying, if you were observing, they would be living and breathing, but somehow not stopping Batya. That's what the Gemara is talking about when it says that they tried to interfere and they died. And this is the yisod that Rav Huttner and the Pachad Yitzchak draws out from the Maharal. That if something's mefurish in the pasuk, it would have been mefurish in reality. Kipshutim. If it's alluded to in the pasuk, because it's a more hidden aspect of reality that's being described. And that is a Yisod Gadol. And the Pachad Yitzchak actually goes further, and this is a very typical little punk of the Rav Huttner, that as true as it is that you, in a sense, we're saying, you have two planes now. You have the physical plane, and you have the more operational plane, the more internal plane. And they're not the same. But it's also true that if you have a person who, from a certain point of view, is called dead because they're incapable, so they're still alive, but they don't look the same. In other words, if you have someone who they're incapacitated, so even if you look at them, you see them as alive, but alive minus, meaning something's missing. They don't look their normal, full self, hearty self. And isn't it true, says Pachad Yitzchak, that the Maharal has told us that the Pasuk doesn't say that they died, but when it says that they're going, it's got letters missing. Because what that means is that as surely as the Pshat will not say that they died, the Pshat says Holchos, but there's letters missing from the Pshat. It looks sallow. It looks this. It doesn't look as labedic as the word should look, because neither did they, even as they were alive. And that's the full expression of this idea. So as we mentioned, these are three comments of the Maharal. Each one of them, opens up a whole new vista. You have the notion of the dogish and the tzaddik. It's a dogish of circumstance, if not of grammar. You have milim or kavot, batesa tzav. On the one hand, choosing to stay there. On the other hand, rooted to the spot, all at the same time. And then you have this holchos, things missing are derech hapshat, which opens up the world of drash and the connection between them. So that is Rechush Gadol, even before the Jewish people have left Mitzrayim. Now, the end of Perek Beis, where things are already getting closer to the time of Geula, and the events really that precipitate the Geula. Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Vayi Bayomim HaRabim Ahayim, Vayomas Melech Mitzrayim. So the old king dies to the extent that he does. Once again, back to Rashi. Vayanchu b'nei Yisroel min avoda vayizaku, and they're all groaning from the work. The Chizkuni says that they only died when the king died. Were they only groaned when the king died? Everything was okay until now, except another Mefarshim say this as well, that they were kind of pinning their hopes on the fact that this was a tyrant whose behavior can't be explained, and hopefully all of his hatred of the Jewish people will go to the grave with him. His successor presumably will be more enlightened and things can get back, which means the dashed expectations of the new king, nothing's changed, but that was too much for the Jewish people. And their cries went up to Hashem. He heard their cries. He remembered the bris as Avram Yitzchak gets Yaakov. And the next thing you know, the Geula is about to happen. Moshe and Mare Hasneh. This is the turning point. And Mefarshim raised an interesting shaila. It seems, and I'm not sure if we focus on this when we describe Yetzias Mitzrayim, even if we would have the pieces lined up, that a critical part of Yetzias Mitzrayim was tefillah, were the prayers. I mean, that's the last thing that happens before the burning bush and things begin to proceed towards Geula. You have two psukim here. They're crying out. Hashem heard their cries. And this is also emphasized, which is very relevant, in the micro story of Mitzrayim, which we say on Seder night, which comes from when we bring Bikurim in Parshas Kisavo, which is only four or five psukim long, which means there can't be anything there which isn't absolutely of the essence, even if you pare the story down to its absolute barest essentials, begins by saying, Vanitzak el Hashem Elokei Aviseinu. We cried out, Vayishma Hashem Eskoleinu, Vayarsam Eslachatzeinu. One of the psukim, one of the four, is about tefillah. That's very important. Sometimes it can go unnoticed, this part of the story. And what's fascinating is, and Mefarshim asks, Ramban asks this question, if we may ask, it really sounds like because we davened, so Hashem saved us. What if we wouldn't have davened? What if there had been no Vanitzak Hashem Elokei Aviseinu? Sounds like, if we just say the story backwards, it sounds like there would have been no Yetzias Mitzrayim. But that's actually rather difficult because there is the terms. There's the covenant of Bris Ben Abisarim, Bachar Chenu, Tzibur Chesh Gadol. It sounds like it has to happen. So what is the role of tefillah with something that has to happen? You could say that even things that have to happen, but nonetheless, the channel that brings them down into the world is tefillah. But Mefarshim add, you know, we're used to the fact that we came out of Mitzrayim well before a simple understanding of how long we were meant to be there for had elapsed. Arba Me'o Shana, 400 years. We were in Mitzrayim for 210 years. And that, of course, is a major question amongst the Mefarshim, Rishonim and Achronim, how to account for these missing 190 years. Can they be accounted for? Yes, in numerous ways. It could be from the time that Yitzhak was born. It could be that the difficulties of the Shibud kind of concentrated really the 400 years of difficult, you know, of servitude into 210 years. It could be because they increased extra-normally. So maybe there was multiple representation of the Jewish people simultaneously. There are many, many explanations. But we should remember that those are explanations, as if to say, there are two questions. Number one, can you account for it? Yes. Number two, but should you have to account for it? Whatever happened to the good old-fashioned 400 years, which is also 400 years, without any cheshbonos? And really what that means to say is we normally look at these explanations, it's from the birth of Yitzchak, as if that was the way it was pre-programmed from the beginning. From the time Yitzchak is born, the clock is ticking, and 400 years after that is 210 years into Egypt, but the time is up. That's not necessarily the case. The pashtus of the time is up is 400 years in Egypt. Is it possible to make a different calculation? Yes, it's possible. Could be from the birth of Yitzchak, etc. But what would cause, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu to shift clocks and consider the time to be up? Because that's not a given anymore. That's not a must. That's the product of tefillah. As if to say, when the capacity existed to reconfigure, but it wasn't necessarily a natural move that would have happened. That's why tefillah is the catalyst. Things were so difficult and we cried out to Hashem. Hashem responded to our tefillahs by gecheshbening the 400 years, which was possible, but that was a possibility that wasn't activated. So that's very interesting just to consider the interplay between tefillah and what we consider to be time. The time is up. For the definition of the time itself was itself under discussion. Now, if we look carefully, and we should, at this pasuk kaf dalet, it states, "Vayishma Elokim es nakasam." Hashem heard their cries. "Vayizkor Elokim es briso es Avraham es Yitzchak ve es Yaakov." The pasuk says that describes Hashem as doing two things in response. Number one, He heard our prayers. Number two, He remembered the bris with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And the parshanut, the important parshanut question here is, what are these two things, and how do they go together? Had the pasuk said that Hashem heard our cries and then proceeded, that would have been a straight line. But something else happened. He heard our cries and remembered the bris. What is remembering the bris? What's its contribution here? That's the shaila. Now, one of the classic commentaries on the Haggadah Shel Pesach is the Maaseh Nisim, written by Rabbi Yaakov of Lissa, the author of Nesivos HaMishpat in the 1800s. And the Maaseh Nisim says something very interesting. The way we describe it is, things got difficult, we cried out to Hashem, and we would say, we davened, and Hashem heard our prayers and responded. If you look at the relevant psukim, you will not see that. That is to say, if you look at Pasuk Kaf Gimel, it says, Vayonchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avoda vayizaku. They groaned and cried from work. Meaning, if you could put words to ascribe to what's happening, they would say, this work is too difficult for us. Where is the tefillah? Not mentioned. And therefore, says Maaseh Nisim, we should appreciate that what we describe, or what we would ascribe to them as prayer, wasn't really prayer. It was a cry. So it doesn't really qualify as prayer. And because it's true, you don't have the natural, so to speak, cause and effect of praying to Hashem and Hashem responding to prayer. There was no prayer. There was a cry. However, in conjunction with, and this is why you have the second element of Bris Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the two together. So then Hashem responded. So in brief, what the Ma'aseh Nissim is saying is, had we cried out to Hashem from the work, as it, and actually davened, so then we can anticipate there would have been a response. But we didn't do that. We cried out. It was undefined. It wasn't targeted, and certainly not expressed as prayer. And therefore, it was only together with the Bris Avos. That's the comment of the Ma'aseh Nissim. And I would like to pursue this, because I feel there's a couple of questions not yet answered. Number one, still, acharei hadvarim ha'ele. So there's something missing from the prayer, and therefore enter Bris Avos. How does Bris Avos serve to go together? At the end of the day, it does seem to be a merging or a synthesis of the cries and Bris Avos. How do they work together? Because arithmetically, it just sounds like crying got us so far, and then Bris Avos took us to where we would have been otherwise had we davened properly. But sometimes, chemically, things don't work the way they would seem to arithmetically. How exactly does Bris Avos work together with these cries? And number two, as true as it is that the pasuk here doesn't say that we cried out to Hashem, and it sounds like therefore we didn't, but together with Bris Avos, it worked out. But let's not forget that in Aramiyo Vedavi, in our retrospective paragraph that we say on Seder night, the pasuk does say, "Vanitzak el Hashem Elokei Avoseinu." It says it. But maybe that only makes it worse. How can it say it if the pasuk didn't say it? The retrospective can't add in things that weren't there at the time. It seems at the time we weren't crying out to Hashem specifically, just crying out. But later on we'll say, no, we did cry out to Hashem. Did we or didn't we? And therefore, I believe that perhaps we may say as follows. The Meshech Chochma in Parshas Vayera explains, and Rav Dessler speaks similarly in the Michtav Melio, the idea of Bris Avos, which is now a connection between us and Hashem. So in formal terms, it's a covenant. But it's based on a connection that was forged through the Avos. And really what Bris Avos is an expression of the fact that the Jewish people, as a result of the Avos, are eternally connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, that connection is sometimes on the surface. If it isn't, it will always be there somewhere. It could be very deeply embedded within the Jew, but the connection is always there. That's the basis of the Bris. That's the basis of the togetherness of the mutual Bris. And because there's a part of the Jewish people that will always be connected to Hashem, that connection will serve to be influential in defining everything that they do on some level. As if to say, what can one make of a cry that's, the work is hard, and it's an undefined cry. If there's no connection, then there's no definition. It's just a cry, it's anguish. But because there's part of the Jewish people that are always connected, and that also contributes to the cry, that means that somewhere in that cry, which is not defined, and not expressed, and not formulated, and even not conscious, there's a part of the Jewish people that is davening to Hashem. That part that's always connected, if that connection was on the surface, the cry would have been a tefillah expressly. But it wasn't. But it's there somewhere, and because that connection is there somewhere, there's an element of tefillah somewhere. It's a fascinating idea. Because really what that means is, given the fact that the Jewish people are always ultimately connected to Hashem, a Jew can never really cry out without part of that cry being a form of tefillah. That the part of them is connected to Hashem is contributing an aspect of tefillah. And therefore, we see how these psukim are harmonized. On the one hand, this pasuk, it described them on a conscious level. They're just crying out from the hard work. Do they mean it as prayer? No. Does Hashem take it as prayer? Yes. But why? Because he remembers Bris Avos. Bris Avos defines the cry as prayer. because bris avos means we're connected. And if we're connected, that there's a prayer in there somewhere, and Hashem took it. That's how these two factors go together, and that's how we can say, looking back, "Vanitzak Hashem Elokei Hashem." We really did cry out to Hashem. We didn't realize that we were doing that because we weren't so much in touch with the part of us that was, but Hashem was. And I think that's why, perhaps, on that word "Vanitzak," we cried out. It says "Vanitzak El Hashem Elokei Avoseinu." We describe Hashem in terms of us crying out to Him as the God of our fathers, meaning because of the connection that He'd made with our fathers, that's how our cry found its way to Him as a form of tefillah. So, I think that sheds a great deal of light on this juncture, this pivotal juncture, which really was the transition and heralded the beginnings of the Geula. The final comment to appreciate an aspect of the situation here. Moshe is sent to take Bnei Israel out of Mitzrayim, and that will happen over the next two or three parshios. And Rav Hyman, that's our Rav Leib Hyman of the Beit Knesset Agra and Beit Vegan, a wonderful darshan and machadish. He explains, and we've discussed this more at length in the past, but just to reference it for Le'inyanenu here, that we need to remember that the event that precipitated immediately the descent into Mitzrayim was Mechiras Yosef, was the sale of Yosef. It's true, it had been preordained on a certain level, it's already from the time of Avraham Avinu, quite so. But the immediate cause was the situation with Yosef and the brothers. And because that's true, part of the Geula from Mitzrayim will have to incorporate a fundamental rectification of that split, of that fissure that existed between Yosef and the brothers. Between the brothers, they'll need to take care of that as they come out of Mitzrayim. And indeed, we find, and with this in mind, the Korban Pesach, which is the event, really on the eve of Geula. If there's one thing you could say about it that characterizes many of its aspects, it's that it has a theme of unity running through it. First of all, it's a korban that has to be eaten families together. L'mishpachoseichem, b'shachatu apasa, a family meal. And again, we're mindful of the earlier family meal, the brothers when they sold Yosef, v'yeshbu lecho lechem. And now you have a healing family meal. The Korban Pesach itself has to be eaten in one place. It can't be split up. It's got to be unified. Ad kedei kach, the Maharal says elsewhere in the Geburas Hashem, it specifically has to be roasted. What's unique, right? Man ishtana ofan hazeh of preparing it, as opposed to every other time of preparing through heat. Roasting brings everything closer together. Other things serve to loosen and the reason why we talk about this in Parshas Shemos at the time of the original Shlichus is because, firstly, says Rav Hyman, it explains to us why Moshe was so adamant and persistent and resistant to being sent as the Goel. He wants Aaron to go. Hashem is telling him. How long can he argue? If you look at the Rashi, you can't believe it. For 7 days he's arguing. That takes a great deal of stamina. And a whole lot of other things. But he wants Aaron to go. Why? So, of course, Aderech HaPashtus, Moshe is on of Mikol Adam, and Aaron should go. But Rav Hyman just adds this element here. Because the whole of Yetzias Mitzrayim is about good, restoring good feeling among brothers. The last thing Moshe wants to do is that him, being the Goel, should cause bad feeling to his own brother. Until HaKadosh Baruch Hu assures him, "Farach of Asamach Belibo," no, he'll be delighted for you. Then Moshe will go. How can you enter to save the Jewish people in a way that it is the antithesis of where they should be arriving now, until he's assured? But just the ringing words here that Rav Hyman draws our attention to, which is just a wonderful and pasuk yud. Of Perek Gimel. Hashem says, Vata, and now, Lecha ve'elachecha el Paro, I've told you the situation, and I'm sending you out. I'm sending you to Paro. These words, Lecha ve'eshlachecha, have been uttered before in the Chumash. Those are the words that Yaakov said to Yosef when he sent him to the brothers in Shechem. Lecha ve'eshlachecha elachecha. And he didn't see him again for a long time after that. And the result, that first lecha ve'eshlachecha spiraled downwards. And a lot of things happened as a result of that. And in a sense, Moshe is coming now to reclaim the lecha ve'eshlachecha, being sent again. And this time it will bring people together, and the Jewish people come out as one. And that is that's the motif that accompanies Moshe as he goes into the tribe. Plenty more to talk about in Mitzvah Hashem. We'll pick up again next week. We'll leave it over for this evening.